Welcome to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. In this hour, we explore the rise of the religious right or Christian nationalism in a new book by Catherine Stewart entitled The Power Worshippers Inside the Dangerous Rise of Religious Nationalism. But first, we explore the House Select Committee on the January 6th insurrection's initial findings and the televised testimony of these discoveries. On January 6th, 2021, a right-wing mob attempted to block Congress from its constitutionally dictated duty to certify the election of President Joseph R. Biden. An insurrection with the intention of seizing the Capitol building, apparently directed by the then-current President Donald J. Trump, nearly succeeded. The House of Representatives have convened a select committee to examine how this insurrection arose, with a stated purpose to learn from the event. On today's show, we'll examine the initial findings of this committee and the role of former President Trump in the attempted coup. Our guest is Jeremy Suri, professor in the Department of History and the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas, Austin. He holds the Mack Brown Distinguished Chair for Leadership in Global Affairs at the university, and he is the co-author of Problems with President Records Are Not Just About Trump with Kenneth Osgood, and multiple books, including The Impossible Presidency, The Rise and Fall of America's Highest Office. He is also the host of the podcast This is Democracy. Jeremy, thanks for joining us. What have we learned? Is there anything new that we've learned from these hearings?
Well, I think there's some big new things and some small new things. Let's start with the two big new things, I think, that we have learned. We've learned that there is very strong evidence that pretty much everyone around Donald Trump was telling him that he had lost the election. He was not surrounded by people who were telling him he had won the election, just the opposite. He found a few people like Rudy Giuliani and Sidney Powell who would confirm that he had won the election. But his own attorney general, who had been seen as his defender, Bill Barr, who himself had expressed concern about fraudulent votes before the election, told Trump in unequivocal terms that the stories of this being a stolen election in Bill Barr's testimony were, quote, bullshit. He made that very clear, as did Ivanka Trump, apparently, the president's daughter and others. That's really important because that establishes then that Trump was not responding to what were reasonable arguments being made, but instead intentionally trying either to change the facts or to convince people of things that he knew was not true, and that would be a form of fraud. Second thing we're learning, I think, that's equally important is that there were some very strong connections between what the White House was doing and what some of these extreme groups, the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers, were doing. We will see more evidence of this, but what we saw in the first hearing was really quite extraordinary. First of all, these two groups coordinating, these are groups that were rival groups, and the ways in which they seemed to be coordinated with the White House as well. For example, they did not go to the president's speech at the Ellipse, but went directly to the Capitol before the speech had occurred and were there while the speech was occurring, indicating they were timing themselves to plan out an attack and for the attack to occur at the time when the president's speech was finished, when he sent people to the Capitol. There's also evidence that they moved into the Capitol in particular ways. There's evidence that we've had from before that's been brought out in more detail about possible coordination with members of Congress, a few Republican members of Congress who might have given these extremists tours. So that level of coordination between the White House or White House allies and these violent far-right groups, that's very important. A couple of small things we should say, I'm sure the hearings will get back to this. Congresswoman Liz Cheney made the point that a number of members of the House, including Representative Perry, sought pardons from the president after January 6th. You don't seek a pardon unless you think you've done something wrong. That's really significant. And then another small thing, it's not really that small, actually, but the further evidence that the White House intentionally told people they were raising money for fighting election fraud, but used the money for other things, such as a $60,000 fee for the president's daughter-in-law to speak at the Ellipse on January 6th. She spoke for 2 minutes, Doug. She received $60,000 of campaign money that was supposed to be used, donations for fighting fraud. Those are small things, but they add up and they show a pattern of fraudulent behavior.
Now, I know they spent a great deal of time trying to emphasize the role of these groups, the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers, right? And that they had planned this attack. And of course, emphasizing things like, you know, the tweets, it's going to be wild, pay attention to this, et cetera. This really does, you know, shatter the image that had been presented, that President Trump delivered this speech almost in a kind of the Shakespearean model when we think of, you know, Julius Caesar. Then the crowd rises up and chooses to attack. How important is that, that there clearly were these groups that knew they were using this time, this date, that speech as something that was targeted, been planned many days before?
Right. It's absolutely crucial for a whole variety of reasons. First of all, just in terms of how we understand that moment, many want to talk about this as a spontaneous crowd that was motivated because they were angry about the election. They were angry about various things. That seems completely wrong. It looks as if this was a very well-orchestrated, planned effort to not only break into the Capitol, but to stop the counting of the electoral votes. This was an effort to stop Congress and the vice president from doing their jobs. And it involved organized right-wing groups, and it involved people with political authority and people with money. And that those who were in the street who got caught up in this were actually not the main actors. And to put it another way, it appears to me that this would not have occurred without the actions of the Proud Boys, the Oath Keepers, and their supporters within the Trump administration. That tells us a lot about law enforcement, by the way. Let's take this away from Trump for 1 second. That means that that's something law enforcement should be focused more upon. They certainly are in the case of terrorist groups. Well, these are terrorist groups that should be focused upon in that way. And I think that's a learning experience that's important for the FBI to know going forward. But second, I think it takes away the argument that this was accidental, unintended. No, this was actually part of the political project coming out of the White House, which I think it's hard to deny. And we knew this before these hearings. The hearings are sort of putting a further exclamation point on it. It's hard to deny that we had a president in Donald Trump who was willing to do anything, truly anything. If it involved asking a foreign leader, Zelensky, shaking him down, threatening not to give him weapons so that he would give dirt on his enemy, or sending goons to attack the vice president, this president was willing to do it. One other small thing I didn't mention before, again, we knew this, but it was brought out in further detail. The president did nothing, absolutely nothing, when the violent groups entered the Capitol and threatened the lives of members of Congress and the vice president. He did nothing to stop the violence. It was the vice president who called the Pentagon. It was the vice president who called in the police along with the Speaker of the House. Strangely enough, it's almost as if Trump was no longer president for 3 hours as he sat and watched the mayhem that he had triggered.
Now, part of what this committee is trying to do by establishing the events of the day is to develop better policies to try to address this. Some of the, you know, critics of the committee have tried to direct attention to the failure of the Capitol Police. And part of that was, you know, trying to blame the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, because of her responsibility with the Capitol Police. But at one level, this question about the Capitol Police is kind of an interesting policy issue, isn't it? That because perhaps it was the FBI not tracking the Proud Boys, not tracking the Oath Keepers, not treating them as potential terrorists, which, by the way, was a policy by President Trump to take them off the list of terror groups that the FBI was tracking, which they had done in the Obama administration. So I guess my question then is, how much should we focus on these policy questions versus just the events of the day and trying to lay out the events of the day?
I think there are a lot of serious policy questions, and they have to do with how we think about security and terrorism in our society. And I think you agree, Doug, we overreact or we misdirect our resources. But there are other cases where we undercommit our resources. This was certainly one. By every account, let's just say this first, the Capitol Police officers who were there were heroic. And I and other contexts have criticized the Austin police, the New York City police, the Minneapolis police. But in this case, we have to say that the Capitol Police and their D.C. Brethren and sisters were extraordinary. And many of them lost their lives. Many of them are still dealing with the consequences of that. Some testified already in the hearings and in the past. But what we do know is that there was evidence early on, days before, that something big was going to happen that was very dangerous. And the vice president's staff on January 5th, the day before, had asked and spoken with the Secret Service about extra protection. They were concerned about the vice president's safety. Clearly, that message did not get through to those who were responsible for securing what happened around the White House and what happened around the Capitol. And some of that might have to do with the leadership internally. We hadn't had an event like this before, so I think there was a certain complacency among the leadership of the Capitol Police. But the other thing, Doug, is that our Constitution is built around the presumption that the President of the United States, as Commander-in-Chief, has one overwhelming duty: to protect the functioning of the U.S. government. That's why we build bomb shelters and things, so that the president has a place to go to survive, not because we want the president to live, but we want the government to survive. And what our Constitution had not thought about was you could have a president who would attack his own government, who would gleefully watch and encourage people, his supporters, to attack at least one of the other branches of government. And so the policy question there is, we have to build some kind of check-in on that. It should probably be the Congress and our police forces should be more prepared, even if the president is unwilling to call them in.
And you're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing the findings, the initial findings of the House Select Committee on January the 6th with Jeremy Suri of the University of Texas. Now, Jeremy, you're a historian. So when we think of the work of the committee, how much of this is really about establishing historical record about what happened that day?
This is probably the most important thing they're doing right now. And it's the most important legacy, really, of the Watergate hearings, Iran-Contra hearings, many others that we could point to historically. It's not just that they're creating documents and evidence that we'll mine and our graduate students will write PhD theses on. It's that they are providing for us a narrative, a fact-based narrative, an investigated narrative that allows us, as we go forward, to understand this moment better so we can improve policy, but so we can also teach citizens what are the essential things they need to know in our democracy going forward. One thing that's absolutely crucial for us to know going forward is that we cannot take for granted that all elected officials will do their duty as lined up in the Constitution around the electoral count. And we have to recognize that there are groups that have interests, even in a democracy, in undermining democratic privilege. That's history, Doug, that's crucial as we go forward, because if our democracy is going to survive and thrive, we have to be prepared to address those issues. Those issues will not go away if Donald Trump goes away. If we put that history under the rug, if we don't tell that history, then we're not prepared as we go forward.
And Jeremy, one of the things that the committee chairs, the co-chairs, seem to have in mind in the creation of this committee was something that would parallel the 9/11 Commission, that would establish, you know, what happened that day. And I think of what's happened since September the 11th, the development of these alternative theories, conspiracy theories, et cetera. I guess two questions. How effective has the 9/11 Commission report been at undermining those alternative explanations, those conspiracy theories? What kind of lessons can we learn about January 6th from that?
Great point. So the 9/11 Commission report was remarkably successful. It's not so much the hearings, it's the report they produced, because it creates a, and I know you've read it as many others have, I mean, it creates a very powerful evidence-based analysis of what happened on that day, which makes it very hard to substantiate a lot of the conspiracy theories. It also makes it hard to substantiate the notion that somehow George W. Bush was responsible for this. We can have an argument over whether he did the right things after the fact. But you read that report, and it's very hard to say this was caused by Jews, or it was caused by Bush, or whatever these conspiracies are. People will still say that, of course. But evidence does matter. The power of your narrative is dependent upon the various evidence you can mobilize. And this came out in the hearings on the first two sets of hearings with the January 6th committee. It was Bill Barr, who so far, I think, has been the most revealing witness in detail, and they have more, of course, from him, who said that every time you would go to Trump and you whacked down one of these silly conspiracy theories, there were 20 more others. There were 20 others that came out, right? And so what one has to do is establish a strong narrative with as much evidence as possible that makes it harder to make those other claims. It doesn't mean those claims won't be made, but it makes it harder for those other claims. And what we do know over time is that the more evidence-based, firmly argued, distributed narrative is the one that usually wins out. So the 9/11 Commission's narrative is the standard narrative. I imagine that the hope is that these committee hearings will produce a report and the standard narrative on what happened on January 6th, regardless of what happens to Donald Trump.
Now, the airing of these proceedings, the prime time and putting this on camera makes me think of another report that the report itself actually is quite different than how it's being reported and the memories. And that's the Mueller report, that you have this description of the Mueller reports about concerns about electoral safety and about, you know, Russian interventions meddling in the report. But now you ask somebody, what did the Mueller report say? They're more likely to say, well, it exonerated Donald Trump, which is not actually what it does.
Correct.
But I guess part of the challenge was that there really weren't effective hearings on the report. They kind of filed the report, expected we'd read it, turned out most people didn't, and they let somebody tell them what it was about. What's the chance that happens with the January 6th report?
I think your characterization of the Mueller report is spot on. I think the Mueller report did show, and I think it has convinced most people, that there was Russian meddling in the election. The question is, was there a connection between that and Donald Trump? And the Mueller report left that open, right? Left that for adjudication by the Justice Department. And then the head of the Justice Department, Bill Barr, who is now testifying against Trump, defended Trump in that case. And as you said, even mischaracterized the report as exonerating Trump, which it didn't do. The members of the January 6th committee understand this. And that is why they're certainly going to produce their report before November, in case the Democrats lose their control of Congress. And their report is, I'm quite certain, going to not leave things open as to who is responsible for what. They will have a very clear explanation. And I'm sure they're going to link Donald Trump and many people around him to the violence on January 6th. They've already made that case as clearly as possible in the first of these hearings. They cannot prosecute, but I think it is fair to say they are laying out a case that the Justice Department can choose, if it wishes, to follow up on. But no one will doubt where they sit on the issue. I think the criticism of this committee that we're already seeing from the right, from Trump supporters, is not that they don't have a conclusion or that they exonerate Trump. It's the opposite. They're angry because the commission is condemning Trump, but that's their point.
But one key difference with, you think of the gold standard of all of this, the Watergate Commission and the September the 11th Commission, is those actually were quite bipartisan, whereas the Mueller report, Mueller was a Republican, but his supporters tended to be Democrats, and we can call this a bipartisan commission. But the only two Republicans, one is not seeking re-election and the other is likely to lose. What's the chance this just becomes yet another partisan battle? And it really just depends on which party you support, whether or not you believe what's coming up.
Some of that is happening, unfortunately. Some of that was true with Watergate, too. I mean, we forget that initially it was very partisan. It's true that this is a committee that is dominated by the Democrats. It's dominated by them because the Republicans chose not to participate. There was an initial goal, initial agreement to create something more like the 9/11 committee. And this has hurt the Republicans. This is a decision they, I'm sure, regret, because it means during all these hearings, they don't get to object. And the language is much stronger than it would be even if you had moderate Republicans on there. And I also think having Liz Cheney on there, it's hard for Republicans to dismiss it as having no Republican voice. I mean, she is Dick Cheney's daughter. She is more conservative than the average Republican. Her voting record is more conservative than Elise Stefanik, who's now the Republican whip. So they can say she's an anti-Trumper, which she certainly is. But she has Republicanism in her bones as much as anyone. And I think that matters a lot, Doug. not for Trump supporters, not for that 30 to 40% of the Republican Party, but for all the others. And I do think that's significant. I think this will be partisan. I don't think we should expect a single ardent Trump supporter to wake up one day and say, yeah, I've looked at this report or these hearings, I'm going to change my position. But we're arguing here over those who are in the Republican Party but not comfortable with Trump already. And this further solidifies what the members of the committee want is they want Trump to be prosecuted, and they want those who are already uncomfortable with Trump to decide after this, no way will we ever support him or listen to him again. And if that happens, that's significant. That is possible. It's not guaranteed, but it is possible.
Last question. They're clearly making a case. The committee is clearly making a case for the Justice Department to consider indictment of people close to the former president, if not the former president himself. Politically, could the Justice Department indict Donald Trump, or are we risking some serious violence across the country if we did this?
I think the Justice Department will indict him. I think as this goes forward, it's very hard not to see places. I think we already have what to me seems a case hard to ignore, which is the wire fraud, the evidence that money was raised to defend the election, and then that money was put into Trump hotels and other things. If you and I do that, Doug, someone shows up at our door with handcuffs pretty fast, right? And that's one of the ways you lose tenure, by the way, too, right? So this is pretty straightforward. Wire fraud, I don't see how that's not prosecuted. And I think that's the route the Justice Department will go. It's the Al Capone approach, right? You go after the smaller crimes that are more provable. And you say, well, we're not attacking him for what he said. We're attacking him for what the campaign he oversaw did. And I think there will be some violence from that. But I don't think that's worse than what we have now. I think what we have now are organized groups bullying and threatening people. So I don't think that would actually create more violence. And I think if Trump is prevented from running or doesn't run, that's a less violent outcome than if he runs and again loses and again claims things have been stolen from him.
And with that, we will certainly have you back on after we've had a chance to see all of what has gone on and what eventually transpires with this committee. But thank you very much for your thoughts on the initial findings of the committee and what we've seen thus far. We've been discussing the House Select Committee on the January 6th insurrection and uprising, the initial findings, the initial reports, and examining the sorts of issues that we're looking for as these hearings continue. Our guest has been Jeremy Suri, professor of the Department of History and the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas. He holds the Mack Brown Distinguished Chair for Leadership in Global Affairs at the University of Texas, and his publications include The Impossible Presidency, The Rise and Fall of America's Highest Office, and is the host of the podcast, This is Democracy. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Doug.
When we come back, what is Christian nationalism? Where has it come from? And what is its impact on contemporary American politics? Stay with us. Welcome back to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. The religious right forms what we now call the Trump base. What is Christian nationalism, and how has it become such a powerful force in American politics? The so-called religious right has been a feature of American politics since the 1970s. Their rise aided in the election of Ronald Reagan in 1980, and they've been a significant voting bloc ever since. But how much is this movement, which is better described as an embrace of Christian nationalism, driving American politics? How organized are the groups that comprise the movement? What exactly is its political agenda, and what is its role in the rise of Donald Trump and so-called Trumpism in the Republican Party? Catherine Stewart is author of a new book, The Power Worshippers, Inside the Dangerous Rise of Religious Nationalism. She is an investigative reporter, an author who's covered religious liberty, politics, policy, and education for over a decade. She's also the author of The Good News Club, The Christian Right's Stealth Assault on America's Children. Thank you very much, Catherine Stewart, for joining us. Your book details the rise of the religious right or of Christian nationalism. What are we talking about when we talk about the religious right?
The religious right is, or as I often call it, the Christian nationalist movement, is Christian nationalism is both an ideology and it's the idea that America was founded as a so-called Christian nation, and right-thinking folks or the true Americans need to take it back. But it's also a means of mobilizing and often manipulating the American public, getting people to vote for hyper-conservative political candidates the movement favors, and thereby concentrating power in the hands of a new elite. There are a lot of different terms that people have used over time to describe this movement. And the term religious right, which sort of was involved in the genesis of the Christian nation identity in its current form, it really, I would say, it got a certain kind of loft in the Cold War. Of course, you know, it had earlier iterations, but the one that matters and the one that is the one that really started, I think, gained force in the Cold War. And there's been a kind of subtle but really important shift in how it operates today. It changes the way that Christian identity relates to nationalism. So if you don't mind, I'd like to talk a little bit about that. In the Cold War, there was this strongly felt need to contrast the American way of life with the communist way. And that led to a belief that it was really important to define and cultivate a distinct American identity. Christianity definitely played a part in that, because the one thing that was supposed to distinguish Americans is, you know, we're a godly nation and they're godless. So a lot of the bad fake history that we're seeing today and fable making coming from people like David Barton, who's one of the movement's leading pseudo historians, those ideas sort of originated in that period where they put one nation under God and sort of anathematized godless communists and called America a so-called Christian nation. You know, it has shifted over time. Back then, this idea of a Christian nation was much broader in a way. It didn't exclude people like liberal Christians like Unitarians and United Methodists and the UCC. Even when Eisenhower put, you know, even when In God We Trust was put on our money, it was sort of outward facing. It was more like we are against the communists who, frankly, you know, the Soviet Union deserved the challenges to its dysfunction and corruption. But there was still a nasty side to that in the attack on, quote, godless communists as a way of attacking forces of progress within the United States itself. So, you know, reactionaries would red bait and start attacking people from within. And I think that sort of kind of attacking people from within is a significant shift. As I said, it used to be a way of consolidating a sort of loosely defined national identity against a kind of communist or an other that was more of a geopolitical enemy. And today, the Christian nationalism tends to be a way of dividing Americans between insider and outsider, pure and impure.
And you raise this interesting question about liberal Christians. At the beginning of the book, you say this is not a book about the so-called religious left. It's actually specifically about Christian nationalism and religious rights. But I mean, religion's always played this role in American politics. I think of, you know, even the discourses about how the churches play a political role immediately gets turned to the role the churches played in the civil rights movement. And one of the reasons why there was the sense that there should be some tolerance of religious participation in politics, because they're leading, you know, they're leading civil rights. What ultimately leads to this religious identity as largely being on the right wing of American politics? Because I mean, there are still Christian left groups, but they're nowhere near as powerful as the religious right groups.
They're not as powerful because they're not candidate focused. They tend to want to respect their, you know, their tax status, their tax privileges. They're not organized, whereas the religious right leaders have invested for decades in all of the infrastructure of building what is essentially kind of a modern political a political campaign. They've invested in data and media, legislative initiatives, right-wing policy groups, networking groups that get the leadership of the various components of the infrastructure all on the same page. And the religious left certainly hasn't done that. And I think if we look back with the rise of the civil rights era, a lot of the religious left groups played a critical role in promoting civil rights and expansion, greater equality and things like that. But then the religious right, the reactionary religious nationalists were much more allied with it was like a marriage between reactionary positions in the so-called culture wars and right-wing economics. So their idea of America as a Christian nation actually became harsher and more demanding. All of a sudden you had to be a Bible believer, sort of biblical literalist as they understood it, in order to count as a proper Christian. So in their view, the liberal United Methodists and liberal Catholics and Unitarians and, UCC were not really part of their movement at all.
Now, one figure that you do focus on, numerous chapters on different figures, but one that particularly fascinated me as a child of the Midwest is Phyllis Schlafly, partially because, coming from the Midwest, also as a woman's voice, because a lot of times you think of these evangelical communities as largely being men's voices, but as a woman's voice. What role did Phyllis Schlafly play in the advancement of this religious right?
Well, she's such a fascinating character. I'm so glad you asked about her. Well, let's just go back a little bit to the late 1970s. There was a rise of a movement called the New Right. And people like Paul Weyrich, Schlafly, Howard Phillips, Alan Dye, and others, they felt the Republican Party had become too liberal. They felt like it was too soft on communism. As we all know, anti-communism was a huge animating factor for Schlafly herself. But they were upset about the civil rights era, the racial equality, desegregated schools, the rise of the women's rights movement, and things like that. And they wanted to drag the Republican Party to the right. They wanted to ignite a hyper-conservative counter-revolution. And they thought about a number of issues that could be used to unite their movement. And abortion, frankly, wasn't the first issue. The big thing that sort of got them up in the morning was the threat that tax privileges might be taken away for segregated schools. People like Bob Jones and Jerry Falwell and other Southern preachers had been leading these sort of involved in these schools that were segregated by race and also religious. And they really were offended that the IRS was starting to look at them and scratch its head and say, well, why are we giving tax privileges to segregation? But movement leaders, they knew this wasn't going to really be a very attractive issue. This is sort of a long way around talking about Phyllis Schlafly, and I'm going to get to her. I'm sorry about that. So they settled on abortion, as the issue that could unite conservative Protestants, conservative Catholics. And by the way, Phyllis Schlafly was Catholic. Also, although she kind of kept it a little, she kept a little quiet about it because at the time, Catholics and Protestants had, were often on, there was a lot of sort of tension among the different groupings, particularly around the issues about school prayer and things like that. And they knew they could bring in a lot of sort of fundamentalists. I think Howard Phillips said, we can even draw in some of our fundamentalist, fringe fundamentalists to the movement. So they settled on abortion as this issue that could be used to unite their new movement, because they knew very well if you can get people to vote on a single issue, you can control their vote, or one or two issues. So all of a sudden, they sort of pivoted to sort of getting, purging the Republican Party of pro-choice voices. And Phyllis Schlafly, here's the thing, she wrote a really extraordinary book about that. It's called How the Republican Party Became Pro-Life, and it describes about a 15, 20-year period from when most Protestant Republicans supported abortion rights. And she describes how they purged these pro-choice voices from the Republican Party in order to draw in, to create this unity among conservative Catholics and conservative Protestants. Other Catholic figures who played big roles in this were George Weigel. The name is escaping me right now. I apologize for that. There was a group that called themselves theoconservatives. So she really played an enormous role in making that unity happen. And so she was a very important figure. You know what's really interesting about Schlafly? She saw her opposition to the ERA and the women's rights movement as a means of defending women's dignity within an inherently and sort of eternally patriarchal order. She has a kind of quote where she says, I'm going to paraphrase here. She said, because women have to bear the consequences of the sex act and, you know, have children, men have to be essentially, I'm paraphrasing again, you know, forced to bear the consequences in other ways, providing for the woman and his children, et cetera. I think she had this idea that without sex leading to pregnancy and children, men would sort of just go off and abandon their responsibilities. Now, of course, we know that this just doesn't work. It was also imagining that, the entire country was sort of this upper middle class, living in this upper middle class utopia where every family could, you know, get by on a single salary with dignity. And of course that, you know, women didn't have aspirations beyond just baby making and homemaking. So it's, you know, it's deeply unrealistic. And of course, many people have pointed to the fact that she herself was a powerhouse and had a very big career. So she was certainly, you know, fulfilling her efforts, her desire to be meaningful out there in the world. But, you know, it's interesting to, when you look at her thinking.
You actually now have presented a little bit of a quandary for the Republican Party, you know, at least, and the role the religious right, you know, was playing here, because you've got these cultural conservatives and waging, nowadays we call these the culture wars, but that kind of butting heads with another key component, you know, of the coalition that's voting Republican, and that's libertarians that would be concerned with the government outlawing abortion or, you know, the role that the church might be playing in all of this. But you highlight the marriage between the religious right and economic conservatism, the idea of low taxes, et cetera, which is not necessarily natural from a kind of a biblical perspective. How did that happen, that linkage between economic conservatism and these culturally conservative movements?
Well, that happened over time, but, you know, it's a really deep synthesis and it's really important to the movement. The movement derives a tremendous amount of support from extremely like plutocratic funders, people like the Prince DeVos family and the Lindsays and the Greens and so many other, you know, McClellan. There's so many other organizations and families that I write about as big funders of the movement, the Mercers, et cetera, et cetera. And these folks are as committed, if not more committed, to far-right economic policy, you know, as they are positions in the culture war. So what they really want is low taxes, or sometimes no taxes for the rich, minimal regulation of government, minimal rights for the workforce. So this is it's a conundrum. So, you know, this is a movement that claims to stand for family values, but yet they're endorsing, you know, they're driving support for politicians who endorse economic policies that are making it so much harder for so many American families to succeed. You know, in advance of the 2020 election, I saw Franklin Graham give a sort of speech in favor of Trump. And he said, well, we like Trump because he's nostalgic for the 1950s and early 1960s. And we're nostalgic for the 1950s and the early 1960s too. So that's why we support him. And I thought, okay. Late, you know, 1950s, early 1960s, let's look at what's happening economically. At that time, the average CEO made, I think it was, I don't have the figure, like something like 21 times the amount of the average worker. So you could join a country club and have a boat, maybe a second house. You could do very well. You could live very well as a CEO. And, you know, the workforce, you know, maybe there were unions and people could, you know, families could survive on a single salary and, you know, you could afford your own home, et cetera. Well, today, the average CEO of a Fortune 500 company earns nearly 400 times the amount of the average worker in their workforce. And what it shows is like we're living in an era of record economic inequality. And this is not like an opinion. You look at the sociological data, the economic data, and it really is creating a real challenge for a lot of American families to make ends meet, to support their children in a way that's with dignity. So that sort of synthesis is very deep. And, you know, we could talk about the history of it. We could talk about James Fifield and spiritual mobilization. We could talk about sort of some of its later iterations. But if you just look at some of these big funders of the religious right today, they're, you know, they know you can't get people to vote on these economic policies that are going to disempower themselves, degrade their health care, degrade the kinds of education that their children are receiving. But you can get them to vote on abortion, same-sex marriage, or some whatever trans issues that, you know, probably don't affect their community, but, you know, provide a good, you know, way to sort of focus people's fear and et cetera. So, you know, I think of those culture war issues as, again, the shiny baubles that the movement leaders use to get people to say, it's like if you have a dog and you say, there's a squirrel, and your dog, like, you know, goes running off. It's sort of, it's just a distraction in many regards.
You listen to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We are discussing a new book, The Power Worshippers: Inside the Dangerous Rise of Religious Nationalism, with its author, Catherine Stewart. So in 2016, a candidate for president, twice divorced, crude in his language, admitting to adultery, admitting to aggression, sexual aggression against women, becomes a favorite of the Republican Party. And in particular, as your book highlights, suggestions that Donald Trump's election was not just something because he favors policies that we favor, but almost anointed by God. How does that happen?
Well, some of it is transactional, because he promised to appoint pro-life judges, you know, pro-life being a kind of shorthand for judges that are going to agree with their agenda. He took in Mike Pence, of course, as his number two, saying, look, I'm going to work with you. And then in advance of the election, he sort of promised to form an evangelical council. And look, he threw open the doors to them. He gave them unprecedented access to public money, I think to a largely underappreciated degree. This is a movement that's very sort of focused on gaining access to public money. So he enacted policies that were favorable to their agenda, privileged people with certain sort of correct viewpoints over others. So there's that part of it. Now, you know, over the years, been going to all these right-wing strategy gatherings and meetings and summits. And at every single one, Trump or his surrogates will say, you know, he'll literally get up there and say, I think I've given you everything you wanted. And in fact, I think I've given you more. And everyone stands up and applauds. Okay, so here's the part of it that I think is really underappreciated. I think he represents the lawlessness of the authoritarian. So I think that they actually, many of them really like his style. They, you know, he doesn't respect the laws. He's a law unto himself. And he, this is a, you know, it's perfect representative of a movement that doesn't believe in equality or pluralism or the best of the American promise, and really believes that a right-thinking minority or elite should be dominating over everybody else, and wants to enact certain privileges for certain groups and have the right to sort of direct hate and contempt toward other groups. So, you know, they've convinced the rank and file that they're engaged in an apocalyptic struggle between absolute good and absolute evil. And if you're engaged in a struggle with Satan, which they sometimes say, you know, they sometimes refer to Democrats or democratic organizations as demonic or satanic, you don't, you know, want the nice guy who's going to sort of negotiate. You want the mean guy who's going to crack heads, as long as those heads belong to your political enemies.
One of my observations about Donald Trump is that at the end of the day, he represents a truly masculinist approach, that this is, you know, the kind of the big man, the strong man. And so certainly one group that he is directly opposed to are feminists, are women's empowerment, and not just women's rights, but kind of a more feminine approach to politics, which frankly, Democrats have embraced quite a bit, certainly since Bill Clinton.
Because in an earlier era, masculinity was associated with self-control, with dignity, with being able to speak well and comport oneself with a measure of strength, personal strength, not just brutes acting like a, you know, an overgrown second grader or whatever. So I think, you know, we can look at it a certain kind of representing a certain kind of machismo, but it really flies in the face of a kind of historic idea of what masculine dignity really was.
But that does remind me, you have a quote from Jerry Falwell saying that Jesus wasn't weak. In fact, I'll use the word you use, that Jesus wasn't pussified, that he was strong, he was masculine, he was, you know, he was cut. Is that consistent throughout the movement, or is that just a couple of individuals that are kind of focusing on the even just the physicality of Jesus and strength, physical strength, muscular Christianity? We always used to refer to that with things like the YMCA movement.
There's a lot of that now throughout the movement. And I'm sure you're familiar with the work of Kristen Cobus-Jimenez. She talks about how the movement has embraced this idea of sort of militarism and machismo. And it's actually a reaction to what Christianity, sort of liberal Christianity, liberal Protestantism had become when, when folks like Paul Tillich and Niebuhr were sort of their idea, they sort of married the idea of a Christianity with social gospel, which emphasizes the social gospel, and was very concerned about, you know, loving your neighbor and doing good, you know, good things for society. I mean, that was really part of what the new right was acting against. They were very, you know, disappointed with that. I mean, ironically, if you look at somebody like Jimmy Carter, he was an evangelical and he was very focused on social gospel in a way he was an embodiment of where a lot of Protestant religion was at the time. And, you know, new right leaders and other sort of folks like Falwell, who represented a much more, I would say, reactionary and severe strain of Christian identity, wanted to diminish their influence in society. And that's where a lot of the, you know, animus for the religious right came from in an earlier era.
Now, another theme you take on in the book is the question of race, because we have this idea of the religious right, and particularly of Christian nationalism, which is really the way that you frame this, as being a white movement. But you challenge that, you know, in many ways. And actually the 2020 electoral returns suggested that as well. Donald Trump did better among Hispanic communities and African-American communities than previous Republicans had. Can you talk a little bit about the racial elements within the movement?
I think for a lot of the white people in the movement is implicitly white, if not explicitly, because it harkens back to an idea of America that was once supposedly all Christian, Bible thumping in their view, and implicitly white. But the movement, and of course, the movement can't separate itself from its racist past, because it got a lot of support from pro-segregationist preachers, folks like Bob Jones, and even in an earlier era from, you know, the pro-slavery theologians who embraced this idea of America's an authentically Christian nation, laws rooted in the Bible, and hierarchies rooted in God's will. But here's the big but. Movement leaders can see the future, the demographic future, as clearly as you or I can. And they recognize that if their movement is just white, they will they may lose key elections. So and some of the, you know, further thinking leaders have made efforts in recent years to reach out to pastors of color, and particularly of denominations like Pentecostal and charismatic denominations that have large percentages of, you know, like Latino vote, Latino Americans and Black Americans and people of color, in order to sort of try to, number one, improve the appearance of diversity in their movement, and also draw in voters that they can sort of mint new voters. So we saw the consequences in the last election, where you had Trump focusing, and the GOP focusing on many Latino majority churches in places like South Florida, throughout Florida, really, in places like Texas as well. And then you saw the dial move in significant ways. I think it was between 2016 and 2020, Latino voters overall moved 8 to 10 points in Trump's favor. And a lot of that, a lot of that sort of stuff happened in Latino majority churches. There's a woman named Milsa Alvarez. She does Latino outreach for the GOP. And at a conference I attended, she said, every single county that we focused on went majority red. So it's fascinating. And then Biden improved, I think, 3 points it was among white voters overall. So, that's not to say that there's not a lot of both implicit and explicit racism within the movement. We can see this in the sort of anti-CRT race baiting, where they're calling everything relating to America, the teaching of America's real history of slavery, segregation, racial redlining, all of that. They're calling it CRT. This is our history. Christopher Rufo, who is works at the Manhattan Institute, and this is the architect of the sort of anti-CRT new culture war that they've got going on. He said, we're just going to call everything that we don't like CRT, and we're going to, tar their brand with a CRT label. But we all know it's race baiting.
Absolutely. And that serves as a perfect transition to the last big point I want to raise. Your chapter 6 is entitled The Use and Abuse of History, which, by the way, is very near and dear to my heart and my own research, my interest in historical memory questions. The context of this is legal battles, Supreme Court battles over the so-called original intent and the way in which issues get framed as to framers' interests, framer identity. And one of the things you point out is that the Christian nationalist movement positions the framers, the founders of the state, as Christians. How much is that a use and abuse of history?
Well, it's an abuse of history. I mean, our framers, had different views on religion, but many of them were unabashedly deists, and they unabashedly created the world's first secular republic. The Establishment Clause of the First Amendment, which is interpreted to ensure the separation of church and state, a phrase that actually flowed from Thomas Jefferson's pen. It has the best piece of real estate in our Constitution. It's the first clause of the First Amendment. So I don't understand why. I mean, I do understand they want power and they want money and all the other things. But, we have to face the fact that our nation is irreducibly pluralistic. And in a nation as irreducibly pluralistic as ours, you cannot have peace without having a certain separation of church and state. Now, that doesn't mean people can't freely practice their faith and don't have the right to worship any god or none, or even express their religious views in the public square, especially, as I think politicians can do that while still acknowledging the diversity of our country and respecting others who do not wish to be compelled to pray or participate in any religion if they don't want to, or be compelled to fund any religion that they don't want to with their tax dollars. But, in the hands of religious nationalists in America, this has all been turned on its head. They view the idea of religious liberty as the right to get tax money and, in addition to the many tax privileges they already enjoy, but to have their initiatives funded by the taxpayer to draw on the public trough. And then they also interpret it as the right of people with certain supposedly correct religious beliefs to direct their hate and contempt toward others and to sort of, enjoy certain privileges, to use the idea of, religious liberty as almost like a get out of jail free card and a way of exempting them from the laws that apply to everyone else.
Now, of course, it needs to be said, as we're recording this during Pride Month, how much religious freedom, religious liberty is about discrimination against communities, particularly the LGBTQ community, and calling that a freedom of religion, but a license to discriminate. But also, this movement has a remarkable ability to expand. As one of the themes of the book is this question of expansion, whether it's the racial expansion that you had spoken of, the expansion from what had been a fairly narrow Protestant movement to include Catholics. Nowadays, we hear frequently the description of a Judeo-Christian ethic as a way to try to bring in conservative Jewish communities as well. It's really one of the main narratives, this remarkable ability to take this coalition and continue to expand it, but then still keep it focused on very specific positions in the culture war?
Well, it's interesting. They know they don't, they still represent a minority of the population, but if they vote in disproportionate numbers, that's what all of the strategic machinery of the religious right does. It sort of turns out their vote in disproportionate numbers. So, like, you know, the evangelical pollster George Barna said, you know, I'm always often hearing people say, you only need 10% in that movement. They're saying, all you need is 10% to change the direction of the cruise ship. So Barna estimated that the most devoted religious right supporters, a group he called SageCons, spiritually active, governance engaged conservatives, there's really active folks. He said they're only 10% of the population, but in 2016, 91% turned out to vote and 93% voted for Trump. And in 2020, the numbers were actually even higher. Now, in a country where 40 to 50% of people don't turn out to vote, and an additional number get our votes essentially stolen from us through race-based gerrymandering, voter suppression, and all of this stuff, you know, those sort of dirty tricks now that they're trying to get, you know, people to contest the, it doesn't take a minority of the population to dominate in election cycles. All it takes is really a very organized and determined minority to dominate. I think that a lot of the sort of election fraud myths that the religious right leaders and infrastructure leaders are spreading have to do with the fact that they feel that they cannot win in a fair fight. So if you can't win in a fair fight, just declare elections illegitimate. I mean, it just shows how deeply anti-democratic and authoritarian this movement is. And, you know, the idea, you know, they approvingly cite the founders and wave their flags, but what they're after is a basically seditious vision of a country.
I think on that point, it's a great place to end this conversation, but continue the conversation going forward. The importance of this group, the religious right Christian nationalists in politics, and the impact they could potentially have on American democracy. The title of the book is The Power Worshippers: Inside the Dangerous Rise of Religious Nationalism. The author is Catherine Stewart. She's been our guest today talking about the book. She's an investigative reporter and author covering issues of religious liberty, politics, policy, and education. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'd like to give a special thanks to the Scholar Circle team, Maria Armudian, the host and anchor, Ankine Agassian and Melissa Chiprin, managing producers, Sud Dongri, webmaster and production assistant. All Scholar Circle shows are archived on scholarcircle.org. You can find our podcast on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle Twitter account, and please join our Facebook page. On behalf of the Scholar Circle team, I am Doug Becker. Thank you for listening.